Hi, this is The Takeaway for Tuesday, December 12th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to have you with us today. This time tomorrow, everyone will be talking about whether voters in Alabama decided to send Roy Moore to the United States Senate. And this time on Thursday, it'll likely be the beginning of the end of the internet as we know it. At least that's the fear of activists who oppose what the Federal Communications Commission appears likely to do with net neutrality. The FCC is scheduled to vote on Thursday on the set of rules from 2015 that classified the internet as a public utility. And as such, internet service providers, or ISPs, were banned from blocking or slowing down some data on the internet in favor of other data. That's basically what net neutrality is, and its future is coming down to the five commissioners from the FCC. Chairman Ajit Pai is leading the charge to end net neutrality, and everyone expects a 3-2 vote to do it. One of the two votes expected to be on the losing side on Thursday in favor of net neutrality will be from Jessica Rosenworcel. She was nominated to be an FCC commissioner first by President Obama in 2011 and then again by President Trump earlier this year. Jessica Rosenworcel, thanks for being with us here on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we reached out to your other colleagues on the commission who want to end net neutrality. We're hoping they'll come on later this week. But in your view, what's at stake on Thursday?
Well, the United States internet economy is the envy of the world, and it's built on a foundation of openness. That's what net neutrality is all about. Those rules have been important for our economy, for our civic and commercial life, and for reasons that are beyond me, some of my colleagues want to take those rules away. I think it will have big consequences for the future of the internet.
Well, what do you expect will happen on Thursday? A 3-2 vote, it looks like now, but then after the gavel comes down, what?
Well, if you take away net neutrality rules, what you do is give broadband providers the power to block websites, to throttle services, and to censor and even manipulate online content. They could carve the internet into fast lanes for websites and services that have paid them off, and then consign the rest of us to slower and bumpy roads.
So what do you think the internet will look like after this decision? Are you talking about a world where you'd have to pay $18 more to get the Hulu and Netflix that you want and pay a little bit more elsewhere to get the Amazon that you want?
Well, what's clear is that broadband providers would have the power to carve internet service up into packages like that. It would wind up looking a little bit more like cable TV than the open internet we know today. And we've seen that happen in other countries that do not have a strong net neutrality tradition.
Now, what about the idea of censorship? And people have batted this idea around a lot. Some people have worried out loud that an internet service provider who wanted to, de-emphasize religious messages could make it harder on their service to read about Islam or to read the Quran. Other people have said, yeah, they could do that, but they would get so much pushback that it would never be viable in the real world. What do you think?
Well, I do think they would get pushback, but the way that the FCC is proceeding right now is they will give them the legal authority to do that, to censor content, to slow down the rate at which you access certain services. So they would have the power. In other words, the FCC would give them the green light to behave in that way.
Well, you've been highly critical of the process here leading up to this vote. You've called the process of public comment and the FCC vote deeply corrupted, which I have to say sounds like a pretty serious charge. What do you mean by deeply corrupted?
Well, here's the thing. Right now, we've received more than 23 million comments from the public in this proceeding. And I can tell you as an FCC commissioner, no other work we do comes close. The public has reached out to us in droves. But because of that volume, I think it's important that the agency study that record. And I spent some time doing this, as did the New York Attorney General. And we found some funny things. We found that roughly 1 million stolen identities are in our comment database. In other words, people's names and addresses were taken and comments were filed for and against net neutrality without their knowledge. That's identity theft. And we've also found that there are roughly 500,000 comments filed from Russian addresses. That's strange and deserves investigation. And then for reasons I cannot explain, 50,000 consumer complaints that have been filed with the FCC are not a part of our record. And when you look at those things, I think you only have one conclusion. This record is a mess. And on the basis of this public record, we're making a vote and making a decision. And I think the responsible thing for the FCC to do is to figure out what's going on and get to the bottom of this before we vote.
Well, even if the record's a mess, and it sounds like it may be, and you were referring to New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman there, do you have a feeling that it would change the votes of your fellow commissioners? It's been looking for a long time like we were headed for 3-2 here, no matter what the public record is.
You know, that may be true, but I think in some ways this is bigger than just this proceeding. For more than 70 years, we've had this law called the Administrative Procedures Act, and it's the way that the public files comments on what's happening in Washington regulatory agencies. It's become apparent that that digital age comment system has problems. And in order to ensure that everyone can participate as citizens, I think we're going to have to figure out a better and more secure way. And this proceeding, to me, represents just the start of that.
Jessica Rosenworcel, let's talk a little bit more about the future of the internet if net neutrality goes away. Let's say 5 years from now, you described a scenario where internet service providers could charge more for the services that people want, make you pick and choose and carve up the internet. Won't there also be competition to give people unfettered service? Hey, our service over here at Zwillick Internet is unfettered. You get all your traffic for one price, one low price of X. And I would guess that a lot of customers would flock to that.
Yeah, you're right. Competition is the solution. But FCC data show that there is not a lot of broadband competition out there. In fact, right now, FCC data show about half of the households in this country only have one choice for broadband provider. So if you're a consumer and you're at home and you learn that your broadband provider is throttling traffic and treating your internet service in discriminatory fashion, you know, in a competitive market, you'd pick up your business and go sign on with someone else. But for about half of the households in this country, they don't have that option. And if they don't have that recourse, it demonstrates just why net neutrality policies are so important.
Are you expecting court battles after Thursday? Do you think this heads into the courts right away?
I do think that this is going to take a quick trip to the courts. I also think what is stunning is that the rules that the agency voted on in 2015, those net neutrality policies, were the first policies ever held up by the courts. In a 2016 decision, they were held up front to back. So they have passed court muster, they're wildly popular, and it makes it kind of silly right now that we're deciding to go another course.
Well, silly or not, it does appear like that different course is in the offing here, Commissioner. And then it makes me want to ask you how final you think this decision is. Look, there's a lot of demand for net neutrality. You've heard it in the comments. You've heard it in the news reports. And it seems likely, you know, that the next time there's an FCC dominated by Democratic choices, this decision could just be reversed. Are we headed into a seesaw situation for the next 10 or 12 years where Republicans undo net neutrality, Democrats redo net neutrality, and the industry doesn't know where it's headed?
I hope not, because I think there is nothing actually partisan about net neutrality. If you are a conservative or a progressive, you benefit from an open internet, going online and finding your community. It doesn't matter if you're from a red state or a blue state. Internet openness matters to you. So I hope that we do not treat this as some kind of partisan pinball. And in fact, I'd note to you that the very first net neutrality rules that the FCC put on paper were in a policy statement when President George W. Bush was in the White House. In other words, they do not have a partisan history, and I'm hopeful that in the future that will be true as well.
Well, if they don't have a partisan history going back the last decade or so, they certainly have a partisan present. Jessica Rosenworcel, commissioner on the FCC, will be voting on net neutrality on Thursday. Commissioner, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we're looking at the American healthcare system all this week on The Takeaway. Today, that weird quirk of American healthcare, why so many Americans get their coverage through work. And we wanted to know, have you ever turned down a new job or a new opportunity because of health insurance?
This is Emily from Mount Holly, New Jersey. I received a job offer from a major company, but who was looking to hire contractors instead of full-time employees in order to not pay them full benefits. which included healthcare. I would have gladly accepted their position, but with no benefits, I couldn't take the risk and actually wound up finding a job which paid full benefits, including full healthcare. Of course, the next year they took that away too.
This is Laura from Camas, Washington. My husband is 64 years old and postponing retirement for 6 more years because of his employer's health insurance. I'm a stay-at-home mom of a 26-year-old daughter with disabilities. We both need his health insurance coverage.
And we got this from Anoka, Minnesota. I've never looked for a new job, even though with my skill set, I could get paid more because my current employer offers health insurance. My boss calls it being trapped in a candy-coated prison.
My name is Eric. I'm calling from Louisville, Kentucky, and I do get insurance through my employer. When I actually moved cross country from Seattle, I opted to step down and take a lesser position at one of our local locations. Due to the benefits package, so far it far outweighs any other one that I have found, and I work for a major retailer. My wife, who happens to work for the healthcare company that I get my benefits through, has a benefit package that doesn't even come close to mine.
This is Ava from Amherst. My employer offers health insurance. I'm working full-time and in graduate school full-time. I want to reduce my hours at work, but if I do, I will lose my health insurance. I cannot sign up for health insurance through my school until the fall. Talk about a rock and a hard spot.
That sounds like one, Ava. Does medical insurance have you stuck at your job? Have you ever turned down a job because of health coverage? From Austin, Texas, I once turned down a higher paying job because the difference in benefits between the higher paying job and the job I already had. I could have made more money, but knowing we were pregnant and expecting a hospital delivery and a stay, I could see the medical expenses in the new job would be much higher than in the old one. And we got this from Winter Park, Florida. My wife is leaving her job with benefits, and I will put her on my plan. The health benefits are her biggest reservation about leaving that old job. It takes away too much life energy that we have to worry about this at our stage of life, or at any stage of life for that matter. Do you feel stuck in your current job because of health coverage? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Join this conversation on our Facebook page or at the website at thetakeaway.org. Welcome back. It's The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. It's Election Day in Alabama today. This is an off-year special election for a Senate seat, and that's one race, let's face it, that the rest of the country would usually ignore. Well, not this time. It was time for closing arguments in Alabama last night. Here was Kayla Moore, wife of Republican candidate Roy Moore, veering away from the familiar charge that Roy Moore had sexual contact with teenage girls as young as 14.
Fake news would tell you that we don't care for Jews. I tell you all this because I've seen it all, so I just want to set the record straight while they're here. One of our attorneys is a Jew.
It's a new tack for Kayla Moore there. Well, President Trump won Alabama by nearly 30 points, and Alabama shouldn't even be an idea for Democrats. In fact, Alabama hasn't elected a Democratic senator since way back in 1992. By the way, can you name who that was? Tweet me if you think you know the answer to that one. Anyway, Alabama is not a place Republicans expected to be in a real race with Democrat Doug Jones. Governor Bill Haslam of Tennessee is chairman of the Republican Governors Association. And to people like Governor Haslam, the Roy Moore phenomenon is bad news for the future of the GOP.
I think you could have come away with the wrong impression while Obama was in the White House, because there was such a pushback against him that we gained a lot of seats. We gained 10 governor seats. We gained 983 legislative seats around the country. And don't confuse the wind in the face of your opponent with a wind being at your back. We have to figure out a way to reach out to that younger voter as well as the minority voter.
And how do you do that? Look, there have been Republicans like you who've been calling for this for 8 years, and your party has gone in precisely the opposite direction by embracing President Trump. What are the policies? What are the ways that your party would actually appeal to younger voters, to minority voters, and to women voters, when so much of the loudest megaphone message coming from the Oval Office is precisely different
So I would argue we can do that. Look at the results in governor's races around the country. Greg Abbott in Texas, who did very, very well with Hispanic vote. Charlie Baker, who wins in Massachusetts as a Republican and still has a 70% approval rating like Governor Hogan does in Maryland, pointing to the fact that we have a Republican governor in Vermont, Bernie Sanders' home state. So my point would be, as Republicans, we have a message that does resonate with folks. But to win in the blue states or even the purple states, we have to have candidates that not only can speak to that message, but have to be comfortable speaking to it.
I get what you're saying, and it's a fine strategy, Governor, and that some of the things that I see are so much different. The Republican National Committee just poured $170,000 into Alabama to help elect Roy Moore, at the direction of the president, of course. But again, if you want to impress young voters, minority voters, and particularly married woman voters, throwing the party's full weight behind Roy Moore probably wasn't a great way to do it.
No, I mean, I would agree with what feels to me like a majority of our Republican senators in Washington who have said, we disagree with that move. That was not a smart move. Forget smart. Is it the right thing to do? And I'll be on the side of those folks who'd say, I don't think that's where the RNC needs to be putting their money. That's not the message of who we want to be. And it's going to, if he does win, it's a problem once he gets to Washington that will continue to be around. So I fully agree that's not a helpful development for the party or for us as we try to win governor's races around the country.
Can you give me an example of one or two policies that you think would be great for Republicans to champion that would appeal to minority voters, voters of color and women without losing, I don't know, what Joe Walsh called his angry white caucus that makes up so much of the Republican base now?
Sure. I'll give you something we've done in Tennessee. Several years ago, we launched the Tennessee Promise, first state to have 2 years free of community college or technical school to everyone. And you might say, well, that sounds like another entitlement. The Republicans are against entitlements. But I would argue it's this. And in today's world, you can't argue that there's not income inequality. I don't care what your politics are. We have income inequality. The question is, what are you going to do about it? The Democrats would say, let's just redivide the pie. But I would argue their math doesn't work. And the only thing that can change it is giving more people the opportunity to compete in an environment where more qualification and more technical training is needed than ever before. As Republicans, I think we could actually lead with that issue. And then we could say to folks who thought, well, we're not a college-going family, say, well, yes, you are, and it's free, and here's why you need to start thinking about that in third grade.
Bread and butter economics. It sounds like you want to fight with Bernie Sanders for the hearts and minds of working class voters.
Well, I mean, we don't just believe these things because they benefit rich people or because there's some self-interest in it. But we actually think that's how things work best, that we think our whole system of democratic capitalism has created the best economy in the world. And one of my fears is that you have a younger generation that is just saying, A, I'm getting turned off by the whole politics thing. B, every time I hear and read about business, it sounds like they're the bad guys. And where we say, no, that's actually, it's a great system for creating opportunity. And I'll take my system over Bernie's system in terms of producing better outcomes every day.
You know, Governor, I think a lot of young people would love a policy of free community college championed by a Republican. And then I think they might click to the next news item and see that Republicans are passing a tax bill that makes tuition taxable income and say, wait a second, that's not the party for me at all.
For me, I look at that tax bill and say it's doing something really big. And this is what some of your listeners, given the geography, probably don't like is I think we're doing the right thing and taking away the ability to deduct your state and local taxes against federal taxes. Our whole system of federalism was set up saying every state gets to decide how they want to run things. And if you want to have a really generous program and tax people more, that's your privilege. You get to go do that. But you shouldn't make the rest of the country subsidize that for you. And that's the system we have today.
So, Governor, how are we going to know? Let's give you a couple years. I think 2018 is going to be good for Democrats. That's a midterm. Donald Trump's unpopular. We get that. How are we going to know when I look back on this conversation now that the advice that you're giving today for your party to appeal to a broader base of Americans has started to take root?
The argument that I would make is this. Look what we can do as Republicans if we elect the right people. Again, we have 33 governors around the country and all these blue states. And my point would be we have arguments that resonate with folks. But we can't just write off a big chunk of the country and realistically expect to have the right to govern.
Can you write him in with Donald Trump still being the leader of the Republican Party? Be honest.
I'll say this. If the economy keeps going and people's economic circumstances keep improving, people are going to have a whole different view.
Governor Bill Haslam of Tennessee, thank you, sir.
Thanks. I enjoyed visiting. Look forward to talking again.
By the way, the answer to that trivia, Alabama hasn't elected a Democratic senator since 1992. That was Richard Shelby, who is still a senator from Alabama. He was a Democrat then until he switched to Republican in 1994. And in 2017, in his fifth term, Republican Richard Shelby says he did not vote for Roy Moore. It's been 3 weeks since Robert Mugabe agreed to step down as president of Zimbabwe. That was only after a military coup ended Mugabe's 37-year run ruling over that country. The former vice president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, is Zimbabwe's new president until elections are held next year. And now Zimbabwe is staring at a future without Robert Mugabe for the first time in nearly four decades. The country still suffers from a decrepit economy, from poverty, and from racial tension. The United States is watching Emmerson Mnangagwa closely. He's still under U.S. sanctions for alleged corruption and for violent crackdowns. Harry Thomas Jr. is in Harare. He's the United States ambassador to Zimbabwe.
Mnangagwa is not interim president. He really is the president, and he will have to hold elections sometime between July and August of next year, which he has promised to do. So we think that is an excellent first step. His finance minister, Patrick Chinamasa, gave a budget speech on Thursday that we cautiously welcomed because he is going to tackle indigenization. He promised commercial farmers that he would compensate them within accordance with the 2013 Constitution. So we are going to see if they implement the things they promised.
It's a moment of possible reform and possible renewal going forward, as you mentioned, but a lot of the old faces are part of the old guard.
Sure, we know that. But it's all up to leadership. We will judge them by their performance. We know that their history, the Zimbabwean people know their history, but they say they're going to perform, and let's judge them by that. Again, President Mugabe, he's so used 37 years. President Mnangagwa has said that he is going to operate in accordance with the Constitution, which allows for freedom of speech.
Look, I take a lot just from the understandable little verbal slip there, because for 30 years, everybody, including you, Ambassador, including me, has been saying Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. This is a new moment.
Yes, it is. And this is my second time serving here, so I've heard that name many times. But again, the people have spoken. They wanted Mugabe gone. They're going to have elections within a year. Members of the opposition have a right to speak and run. We expect this to be nonviolent, but more importantly, we expect this to be free and fair. And we hope that there will be international observers. We hope that they are primarily African, with input from African Union, as well as the United Nations and the South Africa Development Community, and that we have some people from America included.
How confident are you that the elections coming up in 2018 are going to be free, are going to be fair, and are going to earn the confidence of citizens of Zimbabwe in this new moment in their country?
Well, I have a responsibility to make sure, along with the international community, that these are free and fair. And the way you do that is you work with the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission to make sure they're operating accordance with their constitution. The biometric voters registration is going on. A good sign is the government has decided to extend registration. And again, I think that the Zimbabwean people are determined for the first time in many years to have a free and fair election. And you all in the journalistic community can help make sure this happens by keeping an eye and a focus on Zimbabwe, not just during this season, but as we go toward elections.
And you're confident when Emmerson Mnangagwa looks you in the eye, or his staff looks you in the eye and says they intend to have a free and a fair election, that they mean it?
I will hold them accountable by their words and actions. That is the way I am evaluated, and that's the way we will evaluate them, but not just the United States, but their people, which is much more important than my opinion.
Well, Ambassador, I hope that you'll help us keep an eye on Zimbabwe as this transition goes on. I hope you'll come back with us here on The Takeaway and help us report on this remarkable time in their history.
Thank you, Todd.
Ambassador Harry Thomas in Harare, Zimbabwe. The mayor of San Francisco has died. Mayor Ed Lee died suddenly early this morning in the city's general hospital. Lee was San Francisco's first Asian American mayor, known for progressive immigration policies and support for a higher minimum wage. He was 65 years old. Scott Schaefer is senior editor of the California Politics and Government Desk for KQED in San Francisco. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Todd.
Scott, who was Mayor Lee? What's the legacy?
Well, Mayor Lee came from a civil rights background. He was an attorney, born in Seattle, went to school in California, lived here for the rest of his life. He worked in city government. He was a bureaucrat, really. He worked for the city's housing commission, the city purchaser. He kind of worked his way up the bureaucracy, and he was the chief administrative officer when he was picked as mayor to fill out the term of Gavin Newsom, who at the time was elected lieutenant governor. And he was thought to be just a short-term kind of a placeholder mayor for 11 months or so until an election could take place. And then he decided to run for the office, which disappointed and angered a lot of people, but he won, and then he got elected again. And so his legacy, he presided over a very robust, booming economy. Unemployment in San Francisco is virtually nil. The downside is that there's been an explosion of the tech sector under his administration. He's been very close with high tech, and some feel that while that's been a great economic success, it's come at a cost, especially for affordability and the lack of affordability for middle-income folks in San Francisco.
And also highly visible homeless populations in San Francisco. Talk about the tension between those two things in the city. The enormous tech boom, big companies in and around the city bringing a lot of money, a lot of employment, but also, let's face it, a lot of people on the streets.
Absolutely. I mean, San Francisco's had a big homeless problem for many years, and San Francisco has actually taken thousands of people off the streets and put them into housing, but there's still 6,000 to 10,000 people living on the streets. They're very visible. It's shocking to people who come to visit San Francisco. The connection with the tech boom is this. That booming economy brought a lot of people to San Francisco. The population grew by about 100,000 in a fairly short period of time. That's a lot of demand for housing. And so the cost of housing went up, and although the city has been building a lot of housing under Mayor Lee, not enough. And so a lot of people have been pushed out of their homes. And you combine that with things like Airbnb, where people have incentives to get people out of their homes and rent short term. It's been a crisis, a huge crisis, an affordability crisis. And people are finding it very, very difficult to afford to buy a house or even pay rent in the city right now.
Scott Schaefer, Ed Lee also presided over San Francisco during this time that the entire concept, really, of a sanctuary city, which wasn't really new, really reached, I think, the forefront of Americans' consciousness. How important was that to him, and did he intend for San Francisco really to be sort of on the leading edge of the sanctuary city concept?
No, I wouldn't say so. I mean, the sanctuary city policy in San Francisco goes all the way back to Dianne Feinstein in the 1980s. So it's been changed and revised over the years. But Ed Lee, there was recently, of course, a very high-profile trial where the killer of Kate Steinle was acquitted, found not guilty of murder and manslaughter. It was very controversial. At that time, Ed Lee said, or his office said, that the city would always be a sanctuary city. It was proud of that legacy. I wouldn't call him a leader in that movement, but as the first Asian American mayor of the city, he certainly spoke to it and felt that he could identify with immigrants.
So what's next for the city? What's next in the government? Who takes over?
So the acting mayor is the president of the Board of Supervisors, London Breed, an African-American woman, 51 years old. She grew up in public housing in San Francisco. She will be mayor until the Board of Supervisors vote for an interim mayor that will be there until the next election. And so it'll be a change in leadership, a change in style and tone for sure. There's a big press conference at City Hall where no doubt the entire city family will be present to speak about Ed Lee and talk about the future, which, you know, is suddenly upon us with very little warning.
Mayor Ed Lee dead at 65 in San Francisco after more than 7 years in office and two elected terms. Scott Schaefer, senior editor of the California Politics and Government Desk at KQED. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us here on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick, and let's talk healthcare now. We're doing it all this week because the American healthcare system seems like a mess. All this week, our friends at the WNYC Health Desk explore the choices that made American healthcare what it is today. For all the controversy over Obamacare and the individual insurance market, that's not where most Americans get their coverage, not even close. So let's go to Texas. Texas has oil, Texas has the Houston Astros, and Texas is also a big part of the reason why 180 million Americans get their health insurance at work. So how did we end up with this system where employers help cover the cost of healthcare for most of us who are under 65? WNYC's Christopher Johnson says that story goes back nearly a century.
It's the winter of 1929. Central Texans were noticing how unusually warm things had been, especially since it was just a few days before Christmas. And then it snapped. An Arctic front hit the region, sending the mercury into a 40-degree freefall. That's where we meet Alma Dixon.
So Alma Dixon was a school teacher in Dallas, Texas.
Nancy Toms is a historian of American healthcare. She says Alma Dixon stepped on an icy patch of sidewalk.
And she fell on the ice and broke her ankle.
Alma went to see her doctor, who explained she'd need to get a cast for her broken ankle. But Alma made things clear when she reportedly insisted to him, "I can't go to the hospital," because hospitals were getting really expensive.
Well, in the 1910s and 20s, hospitals were really just emerging as the modern hospital that we think of today.
That's Melissa Thomason, an economic historian. She says medical care was evolving radically in the first decades of the 20th century. Antibiotics had finally shown up. Medical schools were revolutionizing.
Physicians started to be trained in hospitals and started to have a very hospital-centered practice beginning in about 1910.
With all these new, well-trained doctors, plus better drugs and technology, more and more Americans were changing their minds about where to go when they got sick. But as hospital quality improved, the price tag went up too.
In the roaring 20s, more and more people started being treated in hospitals. And by the end of the decade, people were starting to associate hospitals with not only higher cost, but also really variable cost. A person could probably afford a physician's visit, but it could take them a couple years to pay a hospital bill.
And when patients don't pay their medical bills, hospitals go broke. That's basically the situation lots of hospitals were finding themselves in the 1920s, including Baylor University Hospital in Dallas. An administrator named Justin Kimball saw that Baylor was struggling. By the late 20s, the hospital was barely hanging on. Two-thirds of its beds were empty, and Baylor was $1.5 million behind in construction debt alone. So Kimball had an idea.
What he said is that if people pay a little bit every month, and on average, if both healthy and sick people paid it, that would be enough to cover the hospital bills for those people who needed to go to the hospital. And the way that they made sure that both healthy and sick people bought it was sell it to groups of workers as a benefit.
Kimball first went after Dallas school teachers, enrolling more than 1,300 of them by mid-December. They each agreed to pay about 50 cents a month, which covered things like rooms, meals, nursing, and casts. Alma Dixon was one of the teachers who'd already signed up.
The Dallas public school system realized the wisdom of investing in an employee benefit. In this case, it was prepaid hospital care.
Again, healthcare historian Nancy Toms.
So she had been paying in, her employer had been paying in, there was a fund there to take care of Alma's ankle. A big part of what's significant about Alma's story is that this is employer-based health insurance. And it was very popular in the United States because it was seen as an alternative to government involvement, to socialized medicine.
Inspired by Baylor's success with this prepayment, employment-based insurance model, the idea spread, first across the region, then the country. Similar plans popped up in Durham, D.C., Philadelphia, and Cleveland. And the one guy who managed to pull all these plans together under one roof...
Oh, Rufus Rorem. Talk about an unsung warrior in the history of American healthcare. But it's Rufus Rorem who is the glue that kind of allows for this original idea coming out of Dallas hospitals to become a blueprint for a national movement.
Roram saw all the disparate plans across the country. And in 1937, he helped the American Hospital Association write a single set of standards for members and providers and merge the plans into one name, Blue Cross. Employer-based insurance got an even bigger boost in the next decade.
The fighting finale to knock out Germany rages throughout Italy.
Really, then we hit the 40s. And then, of course, the U.S. enters World War II, and what happens is wartime production is increasing, and firms need workers to produce all the things that they're manufacturing.
Employers try raising wages to attract labor, but Congress fears that will cause inflation, so it passes a wage cap.
Firms then realize that the only way they could attract workers was by offering fringe benefit packages. I might not be able to pay a worker a higher salary, but I can offer them increasingly generous benefits.
One of the most popular benefits was health insurance. The IRS did its part to nudge things along. In 1943, the agency decided to make employer-sponsored health care totally tax-free. Other changes to the tax code over the next decade or so fueled a big jump in coverage.
It grew dramatically in the 1940s. And in 1940, about 9% of Americans have some form of health insurance coverage, most of them Blue Cross. By the early 1950s, over 60% of the U.S. had health insurance coverage.
Ann Thomason says we got almost all of that insurance through our jobs. So here we are today, almost 2018, in a system that splits us mostly in two, those who get Medicare and Medicaid and those whose bosses cover their insurance, which can lead to a situation known as job lock, where employees are scared to leave their jobs because they don't want to lose their health care.
Honestly, job lock is a concern. Maybe you work for a big company now, but you'd love to start your own business, but you're afraid to quit your job because you wouldn't be able to afford insurance. And that kind of thing is actually detrimental to the economy.
Some research indicates that the Affordable Care Act has been especially freeing to millions of parents, older workers, entrepreneurs, and people with disabilities. That's because marketplace plans offer yet another avenue for those people to get insurance. But efforts to gut the ACA could change that, which has some analysts worried that millions of Americans will feel stuck in a century-old system where the quality of their health care depends solely on their jobs. For The Takeaway, I'm Christopher Johnson.
Christopher Johnson is a reporter at WNYC's Health Desk. Tomorrow, we explore prescription drugs and just how they got so expensive. For more information or to listen to the other stories from the series, Your Healthcare, What Happened?, you can visit the website at thetakeaway.org/healthcare. Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. And now our ongoing coverage of the crisis of opioid addiction and death in America. We look today at how words carry huge weight for people struggling with addiction. Last month, I spoke with an addiction recovery activist named Ryan Hampton. He's been in recovery from heroin addiction for more than 3 years. And he had this to say about the idea of drug addicts.
This is really important to me. I do want to make it clear. I actually identify as a person in sustained recovery, especially when I'm talking to folks on the radio and outside of my own personal recovery community. And that's an important distinction for me because I believe that for a very long time, the media and the culture has called us addicts, and it has stigmatized us. It has put us into this box. I am so much more than an addict today.
Well, that stigma that Ryan Hampton is talking about there, it isn't just about hurt feelings or political correctness. Research now shows that words like addict or junkie or abuser can affect the treatment that they receive and even influence how willing someone is to get into treatment in the first place. John F. Kelly is associate professor of psychiatry in the field of addiction medicine at Harvard Medical School. In 2010, he did research testing two different ways of referring to someone dealing with addiction in a medical setting, and he found that if someone was referred to as a substance abuser,
what it tends to do is it tends to make people think about that person differently, more punitively, more negatively, that they're engaging in willful misconduct.
But if they were identified as having a substance abuse disorder,
they're more likely to be viewed in a medical context, that there is something gone awry with their neurobiology, which is in fact true, that leads to greater perceptions of treatment need as opposed to punishment.
Okay, so John Kelly there at Harvard Medical School, explain those findings for us. How did you interpret what you found? Why such a big difference between the two?
Well, yes, we did find a difference. And this is something that is somewhat surprising, how language actually can make a difference to people's attitudes and perceptions about these very common health conditions. So we actually used a vignette to describe someone in a drug court situation. So they were involved with the criminal justice system in this particular scenario. And in half the vignettes, they were described as having a substance use disorder. In the other half, they were described as being a substance abuser. Otherwise, the story was identical. And these vignettes were randomly assigned to doctoral level. So these were MD, PhDs in the mental health and addiction field. And what we found was at random, when people were exposed to the substance abuser term, they were much more likely to view the exact same person more punitively and less in need of treatment, more to blame and should be more ostracized.
More to blame and more ostracized. What does that mean for, let's say, the physician who's seeing that person or even the judge?
So, yeah, I mean, don't forget, I think it's important to recognize that our language and the terms we use both reflect but also influence our attitudes. And I think this is what has come up in this research, is that we can actually induce biases by using certain terms. So what this means for clinical care and care in the criminal justice system, which is increasingly being used in the face of the opioid epidemic, the so-called drug courts to help people get treatment that they need, is that we need to be very careful about the kinds of terms that we use to ensure that we use terminology that is consistent with what we've learned in the last 25 years in relation to our understanding of the neurological impact of substances on the brain.
But Dr. Kelly, is this just an issue of sensitivity to people in recovery, or are you saying that this can have a direct impact on the treatment they receive or on their medical care?
We don't know whether it will have a direct impact on medical care, but what we do know is that using certain terms, like calling someone a drug abuser, does induce these implicit cognitive biases, which make people more likely to view that person in a negative light, more punitively, which could result in a greater likelihood that that person would get ineffective prison time or jail time as opposed to treatment for the disorder, which may be driving the criminal activity. So it's a very inefficient and ineffective way to deal with it. And I think we need to use language that is more commensurate and in tune with what we have found out about the nature of these disorders over the last 25 years. That is to say that these disorders are really a disease that affects the brain neurocircuitry, that affects the ability of people to control those impulses to use drugs. So we've got a disorder for sure. We now know the nature of the disorder, that it affects the brain, and we need to use language that really reflects that.
So how are you proposing that we get it right in terms of the language that we use?
Great question. I think that we need to use terminology that reflects a disorder. So now the American Psychiatric Association, for example, has adopted language like substance use disorder, which now is the language that is used in our diagnostic system. And this is happening all over the United States and all around the world, that we are letting go of terminology which implies willful misconduct. That is to say, calling someone a drug abuser or a substance abuser or an alcohol abuser in favor of language that reflects a disorder. So using language like alcohol use disorder or drug use disorder. I think it's very important also to recognize that, you know, when we think about other common disorders, which in some ways are first cousins to substance use disorders, like eating disorders, you know, we uniformly refer to people with eating related problems as having an eating disorder, never as food abusers. And yet we describe people with substance related conditions and problems as substance abusers and as not as having a substance use disorder. And that is changing. And I think part of the reason for that is just our cultural attitude for the last 50 years has been around this idea of willful misconduct when it comes to alcohol and other drugs. For sure, there is an initial choice, but what we now know is that our genetics, our biology, and the kind of life course that happens can actually increase or decrease the likelihood that someone would actually become addicted.
Now, Dr. Kelly, I read that you've actually come up with something you call an addictionary that judges or law enforcement officials or even doctors can read that has different terms referring to drug use here that you think can take the culture in a different direction?
Yes, we have developed an addictionary, which is online at recoveryanswers.org. It's now been taken up by the national advocacy organization Facing Addiction in an attempt to try and standardize our language around addiction. So if we can create an dictionary that people can go to, can look it up, you know, what are the right terms? What do those terms mean? Why should we use certain terms and not others? It's all there in that particular glossary called the dictionary. I think if we want addiction destigmatized, we need a language that is unified and that also reflects the true nature of what we're dealing with.
And John Kelly, before I let you go, are you convinced that this change in language can really take the culture of addiction treatment in a different direction in this country? Are you convinced that it can change the national psyche when it comes to addiction?
Yes, I am. As I mentioned, I think our language is powerful. It not only reflects but influences our approaches. And I think we need language and terminology that was more consistent with what we've learned. I think what we have found in our research is that when we do use language that is more consistent with medical facts, we tend to reduce stigma. And that's only a good thing in terms of people accessing treatment that they need that can save lives.
John F. Kelly, professor of psychiatry and addiction medicine at Harvard and the founder of the Recovery Research Institute. You can find it at recoveryanswers.org. John F. Kelly, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
What do you think about the language surrounding addiction? Do you have experience with bias and substance use disorders? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. We always want to hear from you. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, Babbel.com, and Staples, offering print and marketing solutions for business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, signage, and more. More at Staples stores or staples.com/print and marketing. Staples, it's pro time.
PRI, Public Radio International.